The last time I gave a shmooze about a Rav that passed away is 3 or 4 years ago, and it was about Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkelzatzal. And that was the reason for it, was because he was a Rebbe of mine who I was able to learn with. And since I was able to learn by him for a little bit, I wanted to give something on him specifically. So I never learned by Rav Moshe Shapiro. I never learned by Rav Moshe Shapiro. He was never a Rebbe of mine. I went to one shir of his, but I wouldn't call that a Rebbe in that sense. I don't know if Rabbi Sheinfeld went to any shir of Rav Moshe Shapiro, but the reason why I feel like this is a little bit different is that my chavrusas did, my friends did, so even if I only heard snippets of what he had said and the amazing ideas of what people brought back to me, each time it was amazing, I felt there was something different about this. And this is what I ended up finding out. Rav Shapiro was the Rebbe of every single one of my main Balei Eitza, and of all of the Rabbanim that I would say have given me my Machshava and my Ashkafa. This doesn't include my Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Learfield, but other than that, they're all under that category. One of the main people, the person that by far convinced me that I should go into Chinuch, is Rav Nosson Weiss of Beis Yisrael, and he was a Talmud of Rav Moshe Shapiro. You might have heard me speak about Reveille 11 from the Rosh Yeshiva of Shari Tfuna, which is now defunct Shari Tfuna. So Rabbi 11 was a Talmud of Rav Moshe Shapiro. Rabbi Brazil, who was my Mashkiach and Beis, is a Talmud of Rav Moshe Shapiro. And so was my Chavrusa for 2 years, Rabbi Uri Silver, was a Talmud of Rav Moshe Shapiro. So even though I never learned under Rav Shapiro, but if all of the people that I learned, I would say, a majority of my Eitzah from, that I got my Eitzah from, or my Machshava from, I feel like this is a Rebbe of a Rebbe's. And from there, I realized, I sat there and I thought about it. I don't know if there ever has been a Rebbe like this, a Rebbe of this caliber, of this stature, that was a Rebbe of so many Rabbanim. I don't know if that's Shaykh. I don't know if there was somebody like that. Granted, maybe back in the day, there was somebody like that. I'm not saying like the Chazon Ish or Rav Eliashiv or something like that. I mean a mechanech who is a mechanech of Rabbanim, of mechanchen. Every seminary that you could name, every single one, has Rabbanim that learned under Rav Moshe Shapiro. Every single one of them. Pretty much every yeshiva that you went to had Rabbanim that were learning together with Rav Moshe Shapiro at some point of the day. Almost every single one. And that's a pella in certain way. I don't know people like that. Who's a machanech of machanchen? There's Rav Matzio Solomon in Lakewood. We have Talmidim that were in his yeshiva. Rav Moshe Shapiro was never a Rosh Yeshiva. Well, he was a Rosh Yeshiva in America. He was never a Rosh Yeshiva in Israel. He just gave shiurim. And he gave shiurim to everyone all over the place. He was a different person. And for that reason, I felt like we should say over a little bit. Now, what is said to be famous about Rav Shapiro is that his breadth of knowledge, what he knew in all different subjects, and his mastery over what we would call Maimari Chazal, not just the Gadata, because that just doesn't lead credence to everything that he did, but Maimari Chazal, to understand all the different Maimari Chazal and what he was able to do, I would say he was what they call a thinker, a person who was an absolute thinker. In the other world, they would probably call it a philosopher. A person who's considered like a philosopher when it came to someone like that. I think that's what they would say. And every single mimer he touched upon became a brand new sugya. A new sugya, a new outlook on how to live life and how to act and how to do everything. How to learn just in any which place. I know this for a fact because one of my chavrusas was the person that did this. He used to drive him to the morning to the kotel, to the kotel for Vasikin, and then drive him back. Here's what he did. He realized that they were wasting time at red lights. So what did he do? He took out a Gemara, and every time he would be driven, he lived in Har Nof. From Har Nof to the Old City at 5 o'clock in the morning, sometimes 4 o'clock in the morning, sometimes a little bit at 6 o'clock in the morning, right? He would go, at every red light, they would stop, he would open up his Gemara, and he'd start reading Gemara Rashi. They would do Gemara Rashi. When the green light would go, when it would turn yellow and then green, then close the Gemara. He'd wait. They came to another red light. He'd open up. He'd go again. Start reading again. He wouldn't read Gemara. He wouldn't learn Gemara with his driver when they were going because he was afraid that his driver would pay more attention to the Gemara than he would to the road itself. But he did that. When I left in 2005, he had been doing this for 3 years. and he had finished 8 mesechtas at red lights while going to Vasikin and going back from Vasikin. Now, granted, okay, it's not Chulin and Shabbos and Baba Basra and Brachos, so those he wasn't finishing. But Tainis, Megillah, Moed Katan, I don't know, it's been 10 years since then. 10 years. I'm sure he's finished many, many more. Many more mesechtas. This is at red lights. It's just a limud. When I heard that, I sat there and I said, who does that when you're on a bus? Let alone when you're driving in a car, right? As a passenger in a car, thinking that you want to do this, etc. It also shows you what kind of a person he was, that he wouldn't learn the Gemara, he wouldn't speak the Gemara out loud to his driver when the car was going. Because he said you have to pay attention to the road. That also tells you something about a person. It tells you something, what kind of a person it is. It's an amazing thing. My only personal story with him, aside from a shir that I went to, but my only personal story was when I was leaving Eretz Yisrael in 2005. And at that point, this is the height of controversy regarding Rabbi Slifkin's books and what had happened, right, regarding what he had written, etc. It was the heart right there. And I was leaving to start a college program for a yeshiva program for college boys that were in Chicago. And I had a major issue. I knew that I was going to be dealing with people that were learning, studying secular studies all day. And I had no problem with challenging them with different scientific subjects. But my problem was, what's my hashkafa here? What do I do? There were a lot of things that Rabbi Slifkin was dealing with, that Rabbi Moshe Shapira felt he shouldn't have been dealing with, in which I looked at it and I said, what am I going to say? What do I say in the matter? Some of the things, it was easier to explain to a college-level student the way that Rabbi Slifkin was saying it. On the other hand, hashkafically, that's not necessarily the way that I hold. So I went to Rosh Shapiro and I said, I need to understand. I asked people to go to him for me. I got 10 minutes. 10 minutes to be able to ask him whatever I wanted to be able to prepare me before I went back. And I still remember, those 10 minutes was precious. He sat there as he was finishing a shir. He stood, it was on a Friday. I stood outside. We got 10 minutes in an alcove of Little Shul in Har Nof outside of, might have been outside of Beit Dagan. I don't remember exactly where the place was. But I was standing outside there and I got to speak to him. And I asked him, I said, he spoke English because he was in America for a while. And I said to him, what do I do? What do I do when these subjects come up? I know it's going to come up. How do I explain evolution? How do I go through the ideas of how old the world is? What should I tell people? Should I tell people this mimer? Should I tell that mimer? What should I do? And I had it prepared beforehand. I had somebody know that these questions were coming. And his answer was so beautiful, you felt like a fool for not thinking of it yourself. There is no way that I could do it justice in any which way by trying to explain to you what he said right now. All I can tell you is, anything that you have heard from me on science subjects when it comes to how Chazal deal with them is all based on that conversation that I had, the 10-minute conversation that I had with Rosh Shapiro. That's it. Anything that I have is all based on that. Whether it's, I don't know if you want to say right or wrong, that's the hashkafa that I got from him and the one that I was hoping I would hear in the first place. But an idea that was so, honestly, if I went to more shirim, I don't think I'd have any sfeikos in life. And this is what people told me. People told me you came out of shir, you had no doubts that whatever that Maimer Chazal was that he spoke about, that was pshat. It was 100%, that was it. There was nothing else to think about. Just the machshava that was there. For that reason, I mean for others, but to help me become that person that I am today, I have unbelievable Hakaras HaTov. I had a good friend, Rabbi Steinhertz, Rabbi Daniel Steinhertz from Avasaret. And I called him because I knew that he also went to a bunch of his shirim. And I asked him if he has any personal stories with him. And it's funny, the first time he had met Rosh Shapiro, the first time he'd seen him, was at a bris. He wasn't married yet. And he was, all his friends were married, and he wasn't like an alter bacher, he was 21. Like he said he was doing all these schools, all these different schools to try to get married, and they weren't working. So we asked Rosh Shapiro, what are schools? How do they work? How do they go through? And this is what he said. He said, there are things in nature that work randomly, that work not because we understand them, but they just work. Sometimes we'll eventually figure out a reason for them. Sometimes we really have no idea why it works. It just ends up working. I'll give you an example. For all of us, nobody here understands why Tylenol cures a headache. I know there's a reason for it. Those who are into chemistry will probably be able to figure out a reason. Pheromones and all the things that are going on in your head and what Tylenol does or what Advil does. Right? I understand that, but we have no idea. But if you take a Tylenol, we know that your headache is going to end up going away. What happens if you take a Tylenol and then you take, I don't know, a cup of liquor at the same time? What's going to happen then? Anybody know? Well, you're probably going to die. You might not, depends on how much drugs you took. Depends on how much liquor you took. It depends on the percentages, okay? But it's very possible that if you take that liquor together with the Advil or the Tylenol, you're going to die. They don't work well together. It offsets all of the different things that the Tylenol and the Advil can do to your brain. The liquor offsets it. He says, a skula is the way that things connect to each other spiritually. For some reason, by doing something like that, up in Shemayim, they connect and things happen. We have no idea why. Maybe eventually we'll know why. But we have absolutely no idea. It's like Advil for a headache. But somehow that skula connects. A real skula. I don't mean the skula of like hopping on one foot, you know, on a Friday. Those are not real skulas. But the real skulas, they connect up in Shemayim. But if you have certain averos that are blocking, that are against what those skulas stand for, then the skulas can't do anything at all. The skulas have no effect on you whatsoever. And therefore, when a person has those skulas and he does them again and again and again, but he has other things that he's doing that are offsetting everything the skulas are doing, the skulas mean nothing. You could open the Aron Kodesh in the 9th month of your wife's pregnancy, all month long, and she still might only give birth 2 weeks after the 9th month is over when she's induced by the doctor. Now, why? Why? I've been opening the Aron Kodesh. The Rashba says it's a great skula for a woman to give birth. What's the problem? Because there's something else going on. There's something else blocking it. That's the concept. One of the most famous snippets that one could say about Rosh Pir is that he was the seminary rabbi's rabbi. If you've never heard that line, you're lucky, but it's the famous line. Because as we said, almost every seminary rabbi learned underneath him at one point in time. It's true. It's 100% true. There's got to be some truth to it. What is the pshat that he was the rabbi that did that exactly? That he was able to help them carve out their niche in Yiddishkeit, and he was able to help Rabbanim find their way. So Rabbi Menachem Nissel, who's a famous seminary rabbi, he used to be a Rebbe in Derech Or Sameach, he wrote an article in Mishpacha magazine in the Family First section, which normally I would never look at, because it's the women's section, as we all know, right? It's like being in the Esrus Nashim while you're davening, which is absolutely evil and should never be done. And I understand that. I think you all understand that also, right? Not davening in the Esrus Nashim because it's for women. Okay, good. We'll be off that for now. That's just a side note. So either way, I normally wouldn't read it, but my wife said, you have to read it. She knows. She got me stuff from Eretz Yisrael, from people that spoke. She was giving me everything about Moshe Shapiro that I could find. He wrote, and he said that he once asked the Kiruv director, and said, what is the hardest part of your job as a Kiruv director? You run a Kiruv organization, you see hundreds of students every year, and you're trying to be makar of them. What's the hardest part of your job? So he thought about it for a second. Think about that. I want you to think for a second. I know you're not Kiruv directors, right? But what would you think is the hardest part of a job of a Kiruv director? You know what the hardest part is? It's not inviting them for a meal. All college kids like food. It's not getting them to come to shul. A lot of them are very curious and they want to come to shul. You know what the hardest part is? He said, bringing women to an Orthodox shul for the very first time and seeing that they're in the Esrus Nashim, completely separated and excluded from any of the services. By far, the hardest thing he said is getting a woman to be makariv, to be close to Yiddishkeit after seeing such a thing. Hear about that? It's amazing, right? It's an amazing thought. That's the hardest part, he said. Rav Moshe Shapiro said that the Esrus Nashim was not a place where women used to go to daven. In order to understand that, he had to say, you have to go historically. Back in the day, when people wanted daven, they would stand wherever they wanted to. They would have certain words that came into their heads. They would open their hands to Shemayim, wherever they were, whatever they were doing. Open their hands to Shemayim and say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please help me do this, please help me do that. And whatever words came into their mouth, that was their tefillah. There was no need for a set tefillah, because they all had, not nevuah, almost like a Ruach HaKodesh, where they could think. And their thinking was so clear, and they were so connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in so many ways that they were able to say things that was more potent than even the words of the Anshe Knesset Gedolah in our tefillos. And they were able to daven in that way. It was unbelievable. It was quasi-prophetic in the way that they did, to be able to communicate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu their needs and desires to perfection in the way that they did it toward HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But once we were taken into exile, once Gullah's bubble happened, once you had Gullah's bubble, unfortunately, we lost that power. That power was no longer there. Didn't have the same idea. We weren't able to concentrate the way we were. Nevuah and Ruach HaKodesh were taken away from us, and even more so from the common man as well. No longer were we able to reach our hands up to Shemayim and Daven in the same way. You can do it. It's just not the same. Anshe Knesset Gedolah put together a system of prayers in order for us to get done what we need to get done so that we won't get lost. Come on, if you would tell a high school kid now Daven whenever you want to daven. Just whenever you feel like you want to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, go up and put your hands to the Shemayim and go ahead and daven. You think a single one would ever daven? If you didn't force them to daven, would they ever daven? By anybody, I don't want to say by everybody here, by some people here. You think you would daven if you were given the choice? You can daven whenever you want to. You think you'd daven Maariv? You didn't have a mincha? You'd get that together, you'd think to do such a thing. It just doesn't happen anymore. Says Ramo Shapiro, women are different. Women have the ability to daven in their own way while doing their own thing, and they never fully accepted this arrangement. Maybe because they weren't chayiv to go to shul. Maybe because minyanim never applied to them. Maybe it's because of that. But he said, if you look at European shuls, there's barely even an Ezra's Nashim. Huge shuls, but an Ezra's Nashim that's tiny. Absolutely tiny. Because the woman didn't go to shul. They continued to do what their mothers did. They raised their hands to Shemayim while they were baking challah and said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please heal Rafal ben Sarah. Allow that person to be healed. And they'd say it out loud. And they davened, not in the same way that we did. They continue to daven the same way that they used to daven. That Ruach HaKodesh, what we would call Bina Yisera, is still there by them. They have a different system of davening, how they act in this world. And therefore, because of that, they're able to formulate prayers on their own. That doesn't mean they shouldn't daven Shemona Esrei. There still is a chiyuv of davening, and if they're davening and they're not doing their own prayers, then avadei they should be davening their own Shemona Esrei. But the idea, the system that we had was what women did. The Chafetz Chaim said, saw World War I raging through Europe, and he wanted to do something about it. So he called together a prayer session, but this is what he did. He said, get all the men out of shul. We're going to make a tefillah session just for women. All the women take over the shul for this morning or for this Seder, whatever it is. All the women are coming to shul. They should daven for the end of World War I. Can you imagine the Chafetz Chaim saying that? He said it should go throughout Europe, this area, Lithuania, Russia, etc. The women should be the one davening in every shul. They take over. So Ramo Shapiro's father, he was a kid, he wanted to hear what they were saying. What kind of tefillahs would the women say? So he snuck into the Ezra's Nashim. Hear that? This is the only time you're allowed to go to the Ezra's Nashim. Snuck into the Ezra's Nashim and was listening to hear what the women were saying. And what were the women doing? No Shlef Tzibor. No Sefer Torah. They opened up that on Kodesh and they just started screaming in Yiddish. Wailing. Crying. One after the other. That's all they were doing. Screaming out loud in Yiddish. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, save the people. What's wrong? All of them crying. All together, however many women was, this is in the city of Brisk. Every single one of them doing the exact same thing. No siddurim, because that's what came naturally to them. That's what they are. Something we, as men, haven't been able to do in years. Just have not been able to do in years. You want to know why he was a Rebbe of seminary rabbis? Why he became known for that? He understood where women were coming from. We're talking about a Baal Machshava, a person who had unbelievable thoughts and ability to understand what it meant for a woman to daven. He understood it. You have a person like that who's explaining to the Rabbanim in Chinuch why they were doing what they were doing. That explains so much. Not that I'm condoning rabbis being seminary rabbis. Let's be careful about that. I kind of like it that women teach women and men teach men. I'm kind of okay with that, but Rabbi Olsen's okay. But you know who it is. Not that I'm condoning stuff like that. But finally, in one of the best stories I think I've ever heard, Rav Nitzel said he knocked on his Rebbe's door early in the morning after he'd had a baby. Such an unbelievable story, really. Just it tells you everything about it. At the time, Ramo Shapiro's daughter, Shulamis, was fighting a losing battle against cancer. She was not going to make it. She didn't make it. But for a while, this was the point that they say that Ramo Shapiro changed everything about his life, where he became known as a mechanech of mechanechim. But his daughter did not make it afterward. So Rav Nitzel came, and he wanted a bracha. It was in the morning, after chakras. He went in to go get a bracha. Ramosha asked him, what have you learned from the experience? Throughout the night that you were in the hospital, and you had a baby, what did you learn from the experience? Mechanech mode, you know what I'm saying? Like, what did you get out of being in the hospital? What sugya were you osik in when your wife was giving birth? So he said, he thought for a little bit, and Renissel said, brilliant line, an absolutely brilliant line. He said, never in my life have I seen so much suffering being followed by so much joy. That's a chop. That's a real chop. never seen so much suffering followed by so much joy. Shlomo Moshe Shapiro looked at him and he said, Menachem, you should know the life is always like that. All meaningful suffering is followed by joy. So Rebbetzin turned to her husband. She looked at him and said, it's not true. What about death? What about the death of a loved one? That's suffering, and there's no joy. So Moshe sighed and said, there is joy. It's just that we don't see it. That is an amazing story. An amazing story. I thought about that for almost an hour last night. Thought about it for an hour on Shabbos, and thought about it for an hour on Sunday, and thought about it last night. That is an absolutely amazing story. And I know it sounds simple. Maybe you've heard the concept before. But it just shows you what kind of a person he was, the way he looked at things. We lost a gadol in machshava. But not only that, we lost a gadol in human nature and psychology. We lost a gadol that was a leader of leaders and a teacher of teachers. And I don't know, honestly, I have no idea until Mashiach comes if we're ever going to have a person like that again. There may never be a person like this. It's different. It's such a scary concept to think of that a person like that was on this world and I didn't take advantage of it. I took advantage from the Talmidim, but I didn't take advantage from the Rebbe himself. And I'm upset at myself for it. And I know you didn't have the chance. You wouldn't have had the chance. You would have been older by the time you went to Eretz Yisrael, by the time you had the ability to go to him. And that's not on you. It's on me. Because I'm not as good as I could be because I didn't learn directly under Rav Shapiro himself. I'm upset at myself for it. For that reason, I feel even though he's, again, not my Rebbe, he's a Rebbe's Rebbe, four of my Rebbeim's Rebbe, I feel like I missed out on something. For that, I feel like we did need to give something. Yehi Zichro Baruch. It should only be we should learn to how to give over to others in such a way that we become leaders of leaders and not just leaders. Have a good day, everybody.